This is a recording from New Dominion Bookshop in Charlottesville. This podcast is brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Find out more at cvillepodcast.com. On Friday, September 25th, authors Clifford Garstang and Josh Weil read from their new books. Garstang read a selection from his collection of short stories called In an Uncharted Country. Weil read from his new book, The New Valley. They are introduced by David Renaud. Unfortunately, the recorder failed in the middle of Josh's reading, so only Cliff's reading is presented here.
Cliff Garstang received an MFA from Queen's University of Charlotte. His work has appeared in Virginia Quarterly Review, Shenandoah, Cream City Review, the Baltimore Review, and elsewhere, and has received distinguished mention in the Best American series. He won the 2006 Confluence Fiction Prize and the 2007 GSU Review Fiction Prize, and has had scholarships to the Sewanee Writers Conference and the Indiana University Writers Conference, as well as residencies at the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts and the Kimmel Harding Nelson Center for the Arts. He currently lives in the Shenandoah Valley. Where in the Shenandoah Valley?
Stanton.
Okay. That's for people who don't understand.
Exactly.
And Josh Weil was born in the Blue Ridge Mountains of rural Virginia. Where were you?
Around Christiansburg.
Okay. To which he returned to write the novellas in his first book, The New Valley. His short fiction has been published or is forthcoming in Granta, New England Review, American Short Fiction, Narrative, and other journals. He has been a regular contributor to the New York Times and written for Poets and Writers, Guernica, Orion, and Nylon magazine. Since earning his MFA from Columbia University, he has received a Fulbright grant, fellowships and scholarships to the Brett Loaf and Sewanee Writers Conferences, a fellowship to the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, and the Dana Award in Portfolio. As the 2009-2010 Tickner Writing Fellow, he will be the writer in residence at Gilman School in Baltimore. And also, he currently divides his time between New York City and a cabin in southwestern Virginia, where he is at work on a novel. This is a new novel?
New novel.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And you recently had an interview on NPR?
I did on the WVTF.
Okay. Yeah. So, if you all can look that up online.
Should be on your website.
Here, I hope it's available. So we'll start with Cliff Garstang.
Thank you all very much for coming. It's a real pleasure to be here at New Dominion. Since I live right across the mountain, I come over here a lot and I come to meetings a lot. And, so this is a wonderful opportunity. And it's also a great pleasure to read with my friend Josh. He's a terrific writer, and I know you're going to enjoy hearing from his book as well. My book just came out 2 weeks ago, and so I haven't read from it yet. And so I was wondering what I should read from it, but it's a linked collection of stories, which means that there are characters that run throughout, and in particular, there's one family that forms the backbone of the book. There are three stories about this one family, three generations. And it's the first story, the middle story, and the last story. So I thought I would just read from the beginning of the first story that introduces this family. Unfortunately, I didn't know that we were going to be having this heavy rain. I might have picked a different story because the title of this is Flood, 1978. The night is hushed except for snow tickling the dark windows. I hear Pop shuffle into the kitchen. A pan bangs on the stove. He'd said he'd warm up that broth for Alice in case she feels like eating something when she stirs. He's always taken real good care of my Alice, ever since the flood. Pop's 83 now, so I guess he was in his 50s the year the flood washed out the bridge. We'd had mountains of snow already that winter, started around Thanksgiving and was still coming down on Valentine's Day. That was the big storm, close to 2 feet. All at once it seemed whomp on top of the foot we already had. Pop and me made loads of extra cash plowing. About the time we'd finish with our regulars, along would come another blizzard and we'd start all over again. By February, everybody was sick of it, but we figured maybe this one was the end. So we all just watched it fall, pile up on the shed, build drifts against the junipers. There's an old woman who lives in this county and paints pictures of barns and old houses and whatnot in all the seasons, and this looked just like one of her paintings. I have to tell you something about Pop. He worked like a hound his whole life, scraping up enough to buy this farm and move him and Mama out here. That's when the work really started, though, and it never was enough. Had to take jobs in town, too, or they'd have lost the place. Then they had us kids, me and my sister, Irene, and Teddy, who was always sickly and who we buried just shy of his 10th birthday. Never was easy with school and clothes and doctors. Except when he was giving orders, mow this pasture, start planting the beans, don't forget to bring in the cows. Or when we sat down to Sunday dinner, I hardly ever saw him back then. Now Pop's an old man, stooped and gray. He could just sit back and let other folks do it all, but he won't do that. Has to be working at something all the time. Been a big help too, especially now with Alice sickly. Pop's spry enough to do some of the cleaning, and if he didn't tend the garden, we just wouldn't have one. There's no way we could use all the tomatoes and beans and everything he coaxed out of that red clay last summer. It was Alice used to do the canning and such, and Mama before her. Me and Pop don't have what it takes for that kind of work. Plus, with the boys grown, we don't read as much as we used to. But Pop keeps at it. Pop, I tell him, it's a waste to stuff a lot on the vine. You never know, boy, he says, and I'm not quite sure what he means. I've got grown sons, one with a family of his own, and I'll always be boy to Pop. Anyway, back during that snowstorm, me and Alice were sitting at the kitchen table drinking our coffee, Mama at the sink drying dishes, even though the doctor told her to stay off her feet, the dizzy spells and headaches coming too often for his liking, and we were staring out the window, dreamlike, at that snow sailing down, fluffing up in pillows on the pine branches, turning the creek black with cold. Pop was down in the cellar, hammering at something or other, whistling, never happier than when his hands were going. Sit down, Mother, Alice said. Let me finish that. She meant it, too, had the dish towel in her hand, ready to go, if just this once Mama would give in. No, dear, Mama said. You're exhausted. Enjoy a little peace. She knew Alice had been up with Timmy in the night, one of those bad dreams little boys will have. Alice sighed and dropped the towel on the counter, sat back down with me. The boys couldn't go to school, of course, and no point in me trying to get down to the warehouse. I was just starting out in those days after the army, which was why me and Alice and the boys lived with my folks. Alice loved Mama and Pop. They loved her, too, couldn't help but with her easy grin and being prone to break into song on a pretty day. Most of the time, things were good, but Alice was antsy for us to move out on our own, even if it meant living in a shack like some folks do. I was torn, to tell the truth, but I had to take her side. We're going to look for a place, I said to Pop while the two of us were hanging the new stock gate. There was no place to hide from the sun, and sweat poured off my cheeks. Pop wore a beat-up hat with a crushed brim. She put you up to this, boy? Because you got to make your own decisions. It's my decision, Pop. Won't set well with your mother, he said. Which meant, as far as I could tell, that he didn't approve and expected me to abide by his judgment. We went on, and I said no more. At the time of that big snow, Pop was still working, and since he was around that morning, he must have figured it was going to be impossible to get to the lumberyard, even if they were open, which more likely they were not. Mind I said impossible, because if it was just going to be damn hard, Pop would have gone ahead and tried. Probably would have made it, too. After that dreamy morning, we all found things to keep ourselves busy. Mama and Alice cooked up a storm, baking pies, fixing the big roast for supper. Alice taught the boys how to cut construction paper valentines to take to school. I helped Pop in his workshop. It seemed like a good time to try again about me and Alice and the kids getting our own place, but I didn't know how. The snow made everything so peaceful, and to tell the truth, it had been a long time since the old man and me had done anything together that wasn't backbreaking work. I didn't want to disturb that. We tightened up a wobbly dining room chair, then built a little bookshelf for the boys' room that we painted a deep blue to match the old dresser we refinished a couple months ago. They loved the shelf when we finished it. Couldn't wait to fill it up. I remember that blue, the color of the glass Mama collected, those bowls and goblets we still have. Alice wouldn't let the boys outside by themselves in that blizzard, but by afternoon they were wild, stir-crazy, Mama called it, so Alice bundled them up in mittens and boots and their heavy wool jackets, and I took them out, me and Bosco, the happiest little chocolate lab you'd ever want to know. Me and Timmy and Teddy, named for my brother that died, of course, the three of us wore that pup out throwing snowballs for him to chase, only to have them crumble and disappear in his mouth. Drove him batty trying to figure out where they went. The boys had a blast, and we all came in, Bosco too, cold and tired and ready to sit by the fire and listen to the wind howl. By the second day, when the snow finally stopped, Pop and I started plowing. We plowed all afternoon, and I kept on the next morning when Pop finally made it to work. Then I had to head off, too, for a shift at the warehouse. With the roads mostly clear by then, even the schools reopened, and the boys had to go no matter how much they whined. I didn't see anything wrong with a couple of little kids staying home from first grade an extra day to enjoy the snow, but Pop thought I needed to teach them about responsibility, about showing up no matter what. "Won't be no good as men if they don't take the punches now," Pop said. He'd said that same thing when I was a kid, just like when my little brother died. He said men had to be strong, no softies allowed. That's not how I wanted to raise my boys. Made me more determined than ever to move out. Next day, Mama didn't get out of bed till after Pop left for work, which was real late for her, and Alice told me Mama took a nap that afternoon, which she almost never did. "Just a little under the weather," Mama said when I asked how she was feeling that night. She smiled like she was making a joke. A couple days after that storm, 3 feet of snow on the ground and more on the trees and roof, a warm spell set in. You could hear the creek pick up pace a little, suddenly loud like somebody cranked up the volume, and snowmelt trickled steadily in gutters and drainpipes. The sun showed up for a day, and that big snowy dune turned to slop. When the clouds came back, I figured the weather would turn cold again and we'd have another blizzard, but it stayed warm and started to rain, drizzled all night long. Couldn't even hear it, but if you turned on a light, you'd see it misting the windows, still that way when we got up, foggy, like a damp rag set on top of us. Alice dressed the boys for school, packed lunches in their tin boxes, and hurried them outside when the bus came. Mama still felt poorly. Pop had already set off at the lumber yard, and I was fixing to head out too, filling in for a buddy on his day shift, happy for extra hours. The rain came down heavier, and the only thing I could think of was how much snow that would be if it was colder, and how glad I was to see rain instead. Didn't want to see another flake of the white stuff for a long time. I drove off in a downpour. As I crossed the bridge on Sparksburg Pike that goes over the creek, the only way out of our hollow, I had a feeling there was going to be a problem. The creek was already high from the melt, and that heavy rain and all the snow still in the ground spelled trouble. Thank goodness our house was on a rise. Folks who lived down low were in for wet times. That coffee family, Dean and Janet and their kids, had a trailer just about on top of that creek, and I hoped they had got themselves to higher ground. Rained all day. I heard on the radio at work they looked for 3, maybe 4 inches before it was over, and the weather stayed warm. That's what really set us up. In the middle of the afternoon, Sam Poole, a bald fire plug who'd been shift manager long as any of the guys could remember, signaled me up to his office, said I had a call. I never got calls. We weren't supposed to use the phone except in an emergency, so I knew something was up. The first thing I thought about was the boys, something over at the school. With all that snow, a flat roof, and the rain, it could be a problem. My neck got cold, and then it spread down my back and started to shake. I don't pray much, but I prayed then, "Please, God, don't let anything happen to the boys." I remembered what it was like with my little brother, and I didn't think I could take it. "Hank, it's me," said Alice. I calmed right down because there was no panic in her voice. If it was the boys, she wouldn't have been able to speak at all, much less like she was just calling to chit-chat. "What's wrong, honey?" I saw Sam looking at me, pretending like he wasn't paying attention. "It's the bridge. It's gone. It was there when I came in. Irene called and I just drove down there to see. It's clean washed away. Jesus. They're keeping the boys at school until you can get them. You and Pop will have to stay in town. Irene's expecting them. You and Mama okay? We're fine, except..." "Except what?" "Mama doesn't feel well. Worried about the boys, I guess." I picked the boys up at school. When they saw me pull up, they both ran out and grabbed me by the legs. The littler one, Timmy, was in tears, flushed cheeks to match the red sweater we put him in that morning. His teacher, Mrs. Meyer, said he tried to get on the bus to go home, and when she pulled him and Teddy off, he flew into a rage. "I want to go home," he kept yelling. Can't blame him. I wanted to go home, too. Teddy was not quite as worked up. A year older than Timmy, his blonde curls a shade darker, he looked like he was close to tears himself, but wanted to act like a big boy. I tried to phone the house to tell Alice the boys were okay, but by then, the line was dead. It was still raining like mad. Already recovered, the boys hopped into my truck, talking to Blue Streak about the rain and the bridge and how Mrs. Meyer came on the bus and told them to get off, and the Bell kids, all five of them, wouldn't budge, didn't believe the teacher. "Those stupid Bells," Timmy said. The truth was, I didn't believe it either. I'd lived out Sparksburg Pike my whole life, more than 30 years, and that bridge had always been there, and there had been floods before, so how could it just disappear one afternoon? Didn't make sense, and I wasn't keen on spending the night, or however long it was going to be, at my sister's. Pop and Irene hadn't gotten along too well, didn't even speak as far as I knew, not since she married that Catholic fellow, Marvin, and Irene never did cotton much to my boys, loud and boisterous as they could be. I guess you could say she and I were on the outs too, just didn't sound like much fun. So we didn't go there. We drove to the bridge. I'll stop there.
Thank you.